Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome to the show, Ridiculous Historians. As always, thank you so much for tuning in. This is, you know, I've said this before, but this is a really, really weird one. It's a story that may be unfamiliar to a lot of people, unless, of course, you're a fan of sideshows. Do people still go to sideshows?
I mean, it's certainly not particularly politically correct anymore. You're Ben still, though, right? Not a proprietor of a sideshow.
Yeah, and you're Noel.
Uh-huh, I am. I mean, I think the closest thing we've got today would be like a Ripley's Believe It or Not situation where maybe, I don't know, maybe there's some things in there that could be classified as that, but they're not human beings. They're dioramas or recreations or, you know, just a historical kind of exhibit. But yeah, man, sideshows, problematic and fascinating things.
Yes, yes, to say the least. I was also captivated by Ripley's Believe It or Not. I think for people in our generation, that was probably, to your point, the closest that a lot of us came to sideshows. We have to, as always, ask our super producer, Casey Pegram. Before we begin today's show, Casey, I know you're coming in blind with this one. What's your take on sideshows?
I'm just thinking about Sideshow Bob from The Simpsons. That was one association that popped up immediately. But yeah, I'm pretty much where you guys are. Like Ripley's Believe It or Not, the Wax Museum, things you do at Destin Beach on vacation. Those are kind of the vibes I'm getting. So never saw like a genuine sideshow, probably for the best.
Yeah, usually somewhere near the airbrush t-shirt stand where you can get like a dolphin jumping over a sunset.
Exactly. That's right.
A shell. That is painted in some bizarre color. I like the beach life. I like the boardwalk snacks. Today, we are talking about something that happened on boardwalks. Early boardwalk sideshows. Now, today, in 2020, as we know, sideshows often have this terrible historical reputation because there would be people who had some sort of disability, right? Or some sort of visually striking difference about themselves.
That's right. And I mean, you know, it's complicated because oftentimes while those folks were reviled and ridiculed as part of those, it was a society that would have shunned them to such a degree that they probably wouldn't have been able to find gainful employment in any other way. So it's a bit of a mixed bag. Well, while it was definitely, you know, it makes me think of why people had a real problem with that movie, The Greatest Showman, because it really romanticized that whole world. But then there's a very empowered musical number where all the sideshow oddity individuals kind of band together and talk about how they're beautiful on the inside and stuff. But that movie kind of divided people. I quite enjoy the music, though. But you know what I'm saying, though? Like, this is definitely, you know, they were getting paid probably a pittance, you know, but they were fed and they were allowed to kind of live within a society or a mini society that would at least kind of accept them as peers. And often there were, you know, kind of famous ones in terms of individuals, like, you know, you think about the Lobster Boy and all of that stuff. But you have sort of categories of sideshow oddity, things like pinheads, which would have been, you know, a pretty crass way of referring to somebody with a developmental condition that caused problems with the shape of their skull, et cetera. And they kind of had like a pointed skull. That's exactly right. That's exactly right, Ben. And bearded ladies and things like that. The tattooed man, you know, people that had any number of outward conditions that could have been looked at as, you know, their some kind of mutation or some sort of superpower in a weird way, but not in a positive way. I don't know what I feel like I'm having a hard time talking about it and trying to stay relatively PC because it is such a difficult thing to discuss.
Yeah, for a lot of people, the idea of a sideshow instantly conjures images. I know you were probably thinking of this too, Casey, of the 1932 film Freaks. and Freaks did feature people who had worked as sideshow performers in real life, like the microcephalic Schlitzy, who was billed as the last of the Aztecs. And to your point, well, there would be things like conjoined twins. There would be things like, as you said, someone with differently shaped hands, someone who had three legs, but then there would also be people who were capable of extraordinary feats. Like how many people were roaming through the Midwest claiming to be the world's strongest man, mm-hmm. or the largest person? When we think of this, and I think you did a tremendous job explaining some of the problematic aspects of this, but when we think of sideshows today, we have the benefit of retrospect, and we also think in terms of those categories like the tattooed lady, the illustrated man, and so on. But today we'd like to introduce you to a new type of sideshow exhibit that might surprise you. It turned out, for a time in the beginning of the 20th century, babies became stars of sideshows for a very weird reason.
But not just any baby. These were specifically babies that were born early, before the full term of the pregnancy had come to a conclusion. And they're referred to collectively as premature babies. And, you know, folks out there in podcast land may have siblings that are premature, that were born prematurely. There are many reasons that this can happen. Some absolutely just completely a fluke. You can't really predict when it's going to happen. There are obviously more kind of negative and nasty reasons this can happen. Things like drug addiction in the mother. But a lot of times, oftentimes, when babies are born prematurely, it has nothing to do with any negative actions of the mother. And it's also more than possible for that baby, born quite small, to have a completely normal life and become completely healthy. And that is because of some medical technology, specifically something called an incubator.
Yes. One of the main characters of our story today is a Dr. Martin A. Cooney. He knew about incubators. He knew that incubators could play a powerful role in ensuring the health of premature babies. But he also knew that the quote-unquote system, you know, the medical establishment and stuff, didn't have much interest in pushing this new technology forward, because the incubator was a very new idea at the time. There wasn't a lot of money being put into research for this literally life-saving technology. So he decided that he would hit the streets himself, and he built a traveling exhibit that showed audience members premature babies living in incubators. For a lot of us, this sounds like a maternity ward, right? Hey, pre-COVID, I could go to a hospital, and if I'm not too creepy, they'll let me walk by that area.
They sure will. Not so much these days. But Cooney's fascination with incubators, you know, didn't just come like as an overnight thing. It wasn't like the hot new medical device on the street. He studied in Paris under a very well-respected researcher and physician named Pierre Boudin, who was confused as to why, you know, these devices hadn't been adopted more widely. So he actually displayed some incubators in the Berlin World's Fair in 1896. And this was really kind of at the onset of the idea of a fair. It wasn't really what we think of today as, you know, it's sort of devolved into just more of a, you know, place where you can ride a cheap roller coaster. It sort of travels from town to town. There might be some games that you're going to lose your money off of. But at the time, they were really considered these kind of like almost like what we have today with stuff like CES, which is, you know, the massive electronics convention where new technology is unveiled and all of the different organizations and companies that make technology show up and show their wares all at the same time in Vegas. You've been to one of those, haven't you, Casey?
We've been to several, Ben and I. Yeah. Mm-hmm. To cover automotive stuff, some just kind of general technology. It's multiple convention centers, massive footprint, tens of thousands of booths, I think. Yeah, it's quite something.
My favorite memory of CES probably is the weird night that a group of us in the crew got together, and one of us, friend of the show, Dylan Fagan, had never gambled before, and I think Ramsey was the same, and so we set off to try to have a Vegas experience. It was ridiculous. Story for another day, but you're right. These things, World Fairs, CES, stuff like the expos, like the Pan American Exposition, these were prominent high level of fairs. You know what I mean? Like, people would go to these things to see the latest innovations. I think your comparison about CES is spot on, Noel. These were much more like a big up and coming technology kind of convention than they were what you would consider a sideshow today. And that's where these child hatcheries came in. That's what they were called. You would, as an audience member, you would pay a dime. And you can see pictures of this, especially there's some great ones on an article from Atlas Obscura. You would pay a dime and you would walk around and observe these babies living happy and hopefully healthy in these incubators. They're much larger, by the way, than the incubators we're familiar with today. And we have to establish at the beginning of this story, the children were not harmed by being in the incubators. They were on display, so there's, you know, a wound to their dignity, perhaps, but they were able to receive medical care that they otherwise probably would not have received. And this is an idea that went through several iterations before our friend Cooney had brought the act to the United States. So let's stay with the incubators just a little bit and let's describe them. So his child hatchery, or infantorium, as it was called, each incubator in there was about 1.5 meters high. They had steel walls, they had a framework, a glass front so you could observe the children, and they used water boilers to feed warm water into pipes running underneath the babies, and thermostats to maintain and regulate temperatures. What we're saying is that the babies overall were safe in these things. That's key to this story.
Well, I mean, they were more than safe, right? They really desperately needed this, and that's mm-hmm. because premature babies they're incapable of regulating their own body temperatures. And before incubators were a thing, I've read, you know, in researching this and watching, I watched a really interesting PBS. I can't remember what it was called, but it was basically a woman who, antique roadshow style, was presented with this like silver cup from an event at the Chicago World's Fair. And it was connected to one of these baby display kind of situations. And one of the doctors they interviewed was talking about how before there were incubators, doctors didn't know what to do and they didn't have much control. So they would do things like put the babies in shoeboxes and stick them next to a radiator, which sounds really unsafe. Right. So yeah, these things were revolutionary.
Yeah. And sadly, before the rise of incubators, there would be people who would say things like, well, the child has to do its best to survive, you know, and that's a terrible thing for you to hear as a parent. And that's where our story leads us to Coney Island. Around the turn of the century, if you headed to Coney Island, you would see, you know, all the usual Coney Island diversions, although I do believe this was before Nathan's famous hot dog eating contest, which is one of my favorite things. You could go to a newly opened amusement park called Luna Park, but you might also run into a permanent infantorium, a permanent exhibit of premature babies in these incubators. And Cooney was doing this because he needed the funds from these audience members. The technology of incubators for humans was laughed at or roundly dismissed by physicians, even though, as you said, Noel, it had a past before. Like, people knew the thing would work. It's sad when you think that for the first 5 decades of the existence of this incubator, it was functioning mostly as a novelty item.
That's right. I mean, you know, we think of incubators in terms of like hatching eggs, you know, from chicken embryos, let's say. And that's really cool, but not always necessary. It's sort of a little more of like a parlor trick, a scientific parlor trick. It's not something, you know, when you think of like farmed eggs or even mass produced chicken eggs, it's not something that would be employed in that respect. So that's an interesting way of putting it, Ben. Although I can't help but think of the scene from Jurassic Park with the incubator and the baby velociraptor that he pulls out. That's all covered in like bloody slime, and then kind of makes that little kind of, and that's how you know those buggers are evil, because the baby's evil. The grown-ups are definitely going to be evil.
yeah, you're right. But what isn't cute when it's in that juvenile stage? I am clearly biased. I'm a Jurassic Park fan. Mm-hmm. There's even a holiday called July 6th Park by one of my favorite sketch groups, Chris and Jack. So do celebrate it when you get a chance. Your point about incubators is absolutely true. It wasn't until the 1880s when Stéphane Tarnier, a French obstetrician, saw these things being used at a zoo and said, hey, if it works on baby chickens, maybe it works on baby humans. And part of the reason the medical establishment did not immediately jump on the baby train here is that they had a long history of prejudice toward premature babies. It was expensive to care for them. And honestly, as horrible as this sounds, a lot of people thought it was pointless because babies born below a certain threshold of birth weight had high mortality. And then physicians also thought this invention that came from watching chickens in a zoo was unscientific. And they didn't believe that it could actually save people's lives. And that's where the guy I mentioned earlier, Pierre, comes in. And he says, why aren't more hospitals investing in this? We can save people. So he started researching the technology in 1888. He kept running into roadblocks for funding. And that's why in 1896, like you said, he wanted to display these incubators at the World's Fair.
That's absolutely correct. The World's Fair, you know, you'll recall when we were making that CES comparison and sort of the whole like modern day con, and like, you know, whether it's unveiling the newest, you know, smart home technology or what have you. Back in these days, the technology that was being unveiled was like life changing. Really, well, I mean, not to say that technology today isn't important. If there aren't occasionally things that are unveiled at these kind of conferences that do change people's lives, but not the same as like the dishwasher or like the color television, you know, things that like haven't really been replaced. They've maybe been improved upon. They've maybe been given internet connectivity, or you might have like a camera inside your fridge that you can look up on your smartphone in case you need to see how much cottage cheese you have left when you're at the grocery store. But it's game-changing technology in the way that we would see in these industrial, like just post-industrial revolution fairs, isn't quite the same today. And you guys completely tell me I'm full of crap if you think I'm missing the mark on that. But the ones that that really led the charge were European.
So Cooney realizes these exhibits can save babies' lives, and he realizes the public will pay to see this futuristic technology. Eventually, he and Boudin realize that these exhibits are successful enough to make a potential lifesaver for these children. Coney was interested personally in this because he himself was the father of a child born prematurely, his daughter. And he reasoned, if hospitals don't care for these prematurely born children, then we can crowdsource it. He didn't use the word crowdsource, but that's essentially what he did. In Buffalo, New York, in 1901, he built this huge building just for the baby incubator exhibit. He got tons of press, which turned out to be even more important than getting a lot of people in the crowd. And that's how, starting in 1903, you could see the permanent Coney Island baby incubator exhibition. One was at Luna Park, and another one was also in Coney Island at Dreamland. So nurses would tend to the babies, the public would look on in amazement. And the weird thing is, this is still kind of like a sideshow. So there is still a carnival barker here. And I wonder what they're saying. Like, the miracle of technology. The baby is born premature. Through the wonders of our age, we'll be able to live.
I love it.
And so, yeah. They had a pitch. I'm sure they worked on it.
Oh, absolutely. No, but it's also like, I don't know. The thing about it is like premature babies are cute because they're so bloody small and their eyes are closed. They look like little rabbits or little puppies, you know, that are born when their eyes aren't even open yet. And they're real skinny. And so like they're on the one hand, they're adorable. Babies are cute and everything, but they're also, you know, they're not the most healthy looking. They're a little like you're worried about them. There's a sense of oh no, is this baby going to be okay? And I wonder, it seems like there was a capitalization on all of those things. Because I don't know, like the pitch likely did not center specifically on the amazing life-saving technology. That is just my, the sense that I get. What do you think, Ben?
Yeah, he definitely, so there were definitely theatrical elements to this, right, that people were going to see. We know that according to a book by Don Raffle, The Strange Case of Dr. Cooney, How a Mysterious European Showman Saved Thousands of American Babies, Cooney knew the score. You know what I mean? Like, he dressed infants on purpose in too large clothing. He would have nurses slip a finger ring around the entire wrist of a premature child because this was visually appealing, right? And it's like people were watching it for the fascination and a little bit of danger, a little bit of anxiety. Will these children make it? You know, one thing I forgot to mention at the beginning of this, he used the phrase preemies. In 1939, when he was looking back and talking about this experience, he said, "All my life, I've been making propaganda for the proper care of preemies, who in other times were allowed to die." And that's why he said everything that he did was strictly ethical, kind of a ends justify the means reasoning, if you think about it. And here's the thing. This Coney Island infantorium stuff, huge success.
Huge success. He would charge a couple of cents to get in. And again, from that PBS little short that I saw, he was apparently raking in about $1,500 a day. But here's the thing. I think a big part of the success of it in terms of like the viewers wasn't necessarily, it was a pleasant thing. It wasn't like a freak show. It wasn't like, look at that weird looking baby. It was because in their incubators, they looked safe and they looked cuddly and kind of like, you know, nothing could harm them. And that's sort of comforting, especially when you see something vulnerable that's being cared for. That's just a theory, but I think that likely had something to do with the success because he was making that kind of money every day. And this was a permanent installation at Coney Island's Luna Park. And he, while he charged people to see it, he didn't charge the parents of the babies to put them in there. So what does that mean? This is a very complicated individual. Like on the one hand, he's doing this thing that on the surface could seem kind of exploitive of these, unfortunate infants that are having difficulty. But he's also literally the reason that they're like gonna be okay. And he's not charging the parents anything because the medical community hasn't fully embraced this technology yet. So without him and this sideshow, a lot of these babies likely wouldn't have survived.
Yeah, it's true. They have made a lot of money and it went to the children. We know that in 1903, it cost $15 a day to care for each individual baby. That's around $405 a day in these are modern times. And Cooney was able to cover all the cost through the entrance fees alone. But because he was operating in a sideshow setting rather than the maternity ward of a hospital, people viewed him with suspicion, and some folks outright hated this guy. Folks like the New York Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children, they accused him multiple times of exploiting the babies, endangering their lives, putting them on display. But none of these complaints really hurt the endeavor. And by the 1930s, people were coming around and they were saying, you know, this guy is a medical pioneer.
That's right. He's onto something. I don't have the direct quote in front of me, but one of those prevention, you know, of cruelty to children organizations said something like, "How dare you, sir, take a vulnerable small child and put them in the tawdry chaos of the Midway?" You know, like something along those lines. Like it was like he was being a bad influence. Like these babies were gonna accidentally get drunk or something, or catch a whiff of cigarette smoke.
Right, exactly. And so if you happen to see the World's Fair in Chicago in 1933 and 34, lasted more than a year, it's like 18 months, it'd be tough to miss Cooney's display. You would see this huge sign that says, like, "Living babies in incubators."
Exactly. Apparently, it was quite a massive sign. And I see them categorized as being, by the Smithsonian article that we looked at, as the letters being so large they could be read from across the entire fairground, which was massive. This was the Chicago World's Fair. This was like the America's big, like, this is us. We are at the pinnacle of technological discovery, of, you know, pushing the narrative forward. And this was no exception. So you'd think something like the incubator, with all the amazing things we said about it, all the amazing research, would be like in the main hall next to the automobile, you know, right?
Or the Dippin' Dots.
Or whatever. But that wasn't the case, because it really continued the same tradition as his previous iteration of this, as kind of like on the Midway, right? Which they definitely had at the World's Fair. In fact, this booth was right next to one featuring the famous, scandalous Sally Rand, who was a burlesque dancer, known for her ostrich feather fan dance and also balloon bubble dance, and really like got arrested multiple times, charged with like all kinds of levels of indecency. And they had her right next to the premature baby exhibit at the Chicago World's Fair.
Exactly. Yeah. And these incubators, of course, if we're talking turkey here, they were not inexpensive, as you might imagine. The exhibit itself was, I think, the entire cost of it was $75,000 back then, which is around $1.4 million today.
Yep.
And the price went up too over time as it became more respected in the public and the zeitgeist. I believe by the time it was in Chicago, the audience members paid 25 cents to see the exhibit, and they flocked there by the hundreds of thousands. Eventually, this leads to Cooney having a homecoming celebration on July 25th, 1934. And this is kind of, I rarely say this word, but this is kind of cute. It was for the babies who had graduated from the incubators at the Chicago World's Fair that past summer. And this was broadcast live on local radio and across the fairgrounds. So people were able to see the results of this incubation technology at work. And you got to think how amazing it is. It's got to be a warm, fuzzy feeling if you saw these exhibits earlier and then you hear this story and you think, you know, I, in some way, whether through a dime or a quarter, helped these kids live.
It's certainly the surprise twist payoff. You know, I don't like, again, it really seems that at the very least, I mean, what is it? Real live incubated babies. You know, it doesn't necessarily scream charity, but he almost was like secretly getting these folks to contribute to the well-being of these children, even if that wasn't front and center in the whole, you know, concept of the exhibit. He also like had it all schmaltzed up in like red, white, and blue. And, you know, he had nurses running around wearing like starched white kind of uniforms. And the whole thing was very, there was a lot of pageantry to it. It's very interesting. But I think he knew exactly what he was doing.
You might be asking yourself, Casey, Noel, Ben, why can't I go see an infantorium today? You know, I don't want to see it in a hospital. I want the sideshow experience. I want to eat some funnel cake.
I want a little razzle dazzle with my babies, you know?
Yeah, exactly. This was an era, and it did come to an end. After decades of caring for these children, Cooney was credited in the development of neonatal care in hospitals, but the public got familiarized with it, right? It lost that razzle-dazzle we described. It lost that sense of novelty. And by the early 1940s, people just weren't as interested in the novelty of baby incubators. And hospitals were also starting to open their own units dedicated to the care of premature children. And so in 1943, Cooney closes the show in Coney Island. He lives 7 more years. He passes away at the age of 80. The sad story is that he achieved fame, but maybe not financial success. This is what makes me think he wasn't crooked or embezzling. He was apparently broke when he passed away. Did you see that?
No, I didn't see that, but it does make sense. I mean, you know, we're talking a lot of money to buy all these machines and to have the upkeep and to hire the staff. And, you know, it really does feel like perhaps the price of admission was just going back into the maintenance of all this stuff, you know. And he really did just figure out a clever, kind of sneaky way of building like the world's first top of the line neonatal care center. Because it wasn't until, you know, folks took notice of the good that he was doing that this technology did really catch on in a much more meaningful way. I wanted to backtrack ever so slightly just to point out something interesting that is something that was mentioned in the PBS thing that I watched, which I'm going to give you the name of because it was quite good and short and very interesting. We talked about this in the past, that the World's Fair had kind of a history of doing odd human displays, if you get my drift, Ben. You remember the indigenous people display?
Very messed up.
Very messed up. Like this human zoo almost of folks from, you know, African countries dressed in their, you know, indigenous garb and holding spears. And one particular individual was eventually put in like a zoo. And then he was forced to like wrestle with a chimpanzee every day until an organization that worked towards black rights shut that down. And then he ended up in a home, kind of like a halfway house situation, and took his own life. Not to say that this is anything like that, but if my brain moved towards like the exploitativeness of this, that's something that definitely popped in, especially since we had discussed that story before.
Yeah, there's another twist here. Cooney had his heart in the right place, but we were very careful, folks, in the way we described him throughout this episode. Let's see, we called him an entrepreneur, maybe. We implied that. A businessman. We called him a medical pioneer. But there's one thing he wasn't. He was not a doctor.
Almost certainly, yeah. Yeah, that I did feel like I almost like, did I miss that part? Like, you know, because he, it's true. He had said that he studied medicine in Berlin and Leipzig, but there was no evidence that he actually, and he went by a couple of different names. We know him as Cooney. He went by Cohn, C-O-H-N, also Cohen.
Mm-hmm.
There's no evidence that he actually studied medicine at a university in either of those cities. And, you know, in Germany, to be a physician, you have to write a thesis. And, you know, the U.S. National Library of Medicine has copies of all of the German records and have thus far been unable to locate a thesis written by Cooney.
Yeah, he was also super, super sketchy about the specifics of his personal life, which, you know, I respect. He was evasive about his date of birth and where he was born. Later research showed that he immigrated to the U.S. in 1888 at the age of 19. But the problem with that is someone of that age would not have been old enough to be at university in Berlin and Leipzig before going on to do grad work in Paris. He claimed to be the inventor of an incubator, but there's no evidence that he registered a patent. In 1910, he listed his career as, get this, surgical instruments. And then by 1930, he described himself in the census as a physician. So if he had been caught doing any of that, falsely, you know, pretending to be a doctor, That's breaking the law. He could have gone to prison. And the weird, complex part about that is this means almost certainly many of those children would have died.
Yeah, that's right. We've been kind of saying that all along, and not to belabor the point, but because the whole thing is just kind of a head scratcher, right? Like, on the one hand, he did something that was real cool, you know, had a real positive impact. By the way, off mic, while Ben was making an amazing point, I looked up what this PBS clip was, and it's from a show or a series called History Detectives from season 7, episode 4. It's a 16-minute, 50-second clip about sideshow babies. And basically, this all starts with a woman who wants to know if the silver baby cup that she got from the 1933 Chicago's World's Fair with her name engraved on it, Patricia, if there was her mother claimed that she was whisked away from her home as a premature baby who was literally being kept in a shoebox by the radiator, like we talked about, and taken to an incubator at the 1933 Chicago World's Fair. And this episode starts off with, is this even true? She has no evidence of this being true. The woman does recognize the silver cup is, in fact, a genuine artifact from the 1933 Chicago World's Fair. It had the right logo and everything. It turns out that these cups were given to those quote-unquote graduates that we talked about. And she was, in fact, one of the babies that were, that, you know, and again, there's going to be a lot of babies. Mm-hmm. Because this was, like, the show, what did you say, it lasted a year? The Chicago World's Fair?
Yeah, 18 months.
18 months. So I don't want to spoil the whole thing for you, even though I kind of just spoiled a part of it, but there's a lot more information in this. I highly recommend you check it out. Just about, like, a lot of good imagery from the time, archival stuff, and you get to see, you get to go a little deeper into it visually than obviously you can do on a podcast. But she ends up very pleased that she was, that this happened. It starts off a little questionable, and then she ends up being very thankful that you know, because she didn't think she would have survived if not for this gentleman. And that's been a journey like that for, I think, both of us too, Ben. It's from ups and downs in terms of, whoa, WTF, to, oh, it's heartwarming. Back to, you know, somewhere in the middle when we found out that he wasn't really a doctor. But at some point he retired and just said, my work here is done. I've saved enough babies.
Yeah, he claimed an 85% success rate. There's no way to verify that, but it's still far, far better than 0%, right? Or than these poor children having to be left to the whims of fate. And with that in mind, we say hats off to you, Cooney. You're a bit sketchy. That's true. It is a bit of a roller coaster worthy of Coney Island, but you made the world a better place. So I would say thanks to him. You know, thanks for making sideshows a little more wholesome.
Yeah. And I would also argue that in those days, sometimes a little healthy sketch goes a long way.
That's right.
Yeah. Sometimes you had to get it in where you could. And he definitely had a plan. And, you know, as evidenced by the fact that he retired with very little money, certainly wasn't a money-making scheme. It was much more of like his life's work. And I don't know, like, I don't know if this is quite enough for like a big full biopic, but I definitely think that he deserves a place in the history of medicine, even if he wasn't an actual doctor.
And so that's our show today. Thank you, as always, for tuning in. Big, big thanks to super producer Casey Pegram. And I forgot to ask you guys, did either of you happen to be born prematurely?
Not I, though my daughter's sister was, but only just a little bit. But she did have a little bit of, she had to be put in an incubator for a bit, and then she was fine. But she had a little bit of problems breathing. That's a thing that happens too. If they're underdeveloped, they have to, you know, get a little extra help. It was definitely scary, but less so knowing that this tech was out there.
Yeah. What about you, Casey?
I had a friend growing up. I was born on his due date and he was born on mine, but it was only a difference of like 4 days. So that's not really premature. So I can't really lay claim to that. No.
That's pretty cool. I was the opposite. I was born 2 weeks late and I'm still catching up. I was enormous. but we want to hear from you. You can find us all over the internet, the Instagrams, the Twitterables, the Facebookeries. Just go check out Ridiculous Historians on Facebook. We'd love to recommend that one. You can see some sick memes. You can see your fellow listeners both mocking both my crippling phobia of metal and my pal Noel's fear of birds in a very good-hearted, wholesome way.
Usually. Usually. No, we love every single one of the folks over there, Ridiculous Historians, and you can be one of them too and be the recipient of our love. All you gotta do is go to Facebook, enter Ridiculous Historians, and enter one of our names, all three, a joke, a dad joke, some reference so we know that you're alive and breathing and not some sort of creepy bot trying to infiltrate our precious community. You can do that. You can also find us on social media. We're Ridiculous History. If you want, you can also find Ben and I as human people on our own social meds. I am at How Now Noel Brown on Instagram.
You can find me on Twitter at Ben Bolin HSW. You can also find me on Instagram. As I always say, in a burst of creativity, I'm at Ben Bolin. Thanks, of course, to the Quister, Jonathan Strickland, who we need to get back on the show at some point soon. He's busy. He's learning guitar, actually. I think he's okay if we tell people that. And thanks, of course, to Alex Williams, our official slap and bop and slap maker.
Thanks, Christopher Hasiotis, here in spirit. Gabe Lugier, researcher extraordinaire. I'll thank Jonathan Quister. Did you thank Jonathan Quister? That's what I'm going to start calling him now. Just Jonathan, like Jonathan Swift. I'm just going to start calling him Jonathan Quister. I think that works. If you did thank him, I'm thanking him again. If you didn't, consider this the first time with double the love. It's Friday, y'all. We're not entirely here. We've been checked out for about the last 15 minutes. We're giving it our level best.
Speak for yourself. I was paying attention.
Hey, when I say we, I mean the royal we, as in this guy right here with the two thumbs and the glut of dad jokes.
I'm going to tell you a secret.
Give it to
before we get off the air. I made a cocktail, and I've just been staring at it off screen for when we wrap.
Ben, what is it? What is it?
It's an old fashioned.
I'm going to go get an old fashioned too, Ben. Well, I'll enjoy one with you in spirit up there in the clouds, floating with Christopher Hasiotis and our spirit old fashions. We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.